Let's start with the first point. Why people have started to think such a crazy idea scenarios like emerging gravity? Well, it is undoubtedly true that gravity is a very weird force that entails many weird features. I've listed here some of the features that are tantalizing in a certain sense in the theory. But if I would have to pick up, and I cannot discuss all of them today, one feature that I think is really somehow suggesting that there is something more about gravity than not just yet another force that needs to be quantized, I would pick up the space-time thermodynamics. If you like, this is basically something that was realized in the mid-90s by Ted Jacobson, which taken face value has some very weird implication. So I'm not pretending in a few minutes to explain to you all the derivation of the Jacobson, but I want to give you the gist. The gist is very simple. So what Ted did in the 90s, mid-90s, was the following. He was showing that on very basic assumption and assuming that there is a Clausius law for a local Rinder wedge, then you can reconstruct the Einstein equation in a way that is typical of reasoning in thermodynamics when you want to reconstruct basically from energy conservation the equation of state. So how it works? It works in a very simple way, and that can be explained in a few words. So what you do is you appeal to the equivalence principle. And here I'm talking to be specific about the Einstein equivalence principle. So the Einstein equivalence principle, I'm referring to the nomenclature à la will, basically saying that there is free-falling, weak equivalence principle, local Lorentz invariance, and local position invariance and non-gravitational phenomena. Now, local Lorentz invariance allowed to say that locally space-time is flat and satisfy basically the symmetry of the Lorentz group. So I can take a point in space-time, and locally I can construct a Rindler wedge by considering a set of observers that is accelerated, in uniform acceleration. So I have a local Rindler wedge. Then what you can do is the following. You assume that there is a Clausius relation working in this local Rindler wedge. And the Clausius relation relates what? An entropy, and what entropy you can define in empty flat space? Well, the only entropy you can conceive is entanglement entropy. You can imagine that there is a quantum vacuum over it. Given that there is a causal wedge, basically you can introduce a concept of entanglement entropy. Of course, you need to, as we all know, regularize this entropy. The entropy is divergent. Well, you assume that there is a cutoff, and this cutoff is of gravitational origin. Now, you do a further step. This cutoff here is this alpha in this expression. You do a further step. You assume that the cutoff is space-time independent. So you go beyond the Einstein equivalence principle. You're assuming what is called the strong equivalence principle. And the strongest equivalence principle generally is the principle that you use to select only GR, and not strong gravity, but that is a scalar theory of gravity, among all the possible theory of gravity. So then you write your variation in entropy when there is a flux of matter through your wedge. And for matter, you consider anything that admits a covariantly conserved stress energy tensor. Done that, you basically impose the Clausius relation, and you may wonder what is the temperature appearing in the Clausius relation. Well, you have a natural notion of temperature in the Rindler wedge, which is the so-called Unruh temperature. This Unruh temperature is basically the temperature associated to uniformly accelerated observers that are living in this local Rindler wedge. So the ingredients are the following. Here, basically, you're saying that the flux is related to the conserved stress energy tensor, or whatever is the matter in your system. You are assuming that the variation in the entropy is directly related to being the entanglement entropy proportional to the area, can be expressed directly as the local variation of the expansion. And what you do? You basically, you have to write the expansion in this point. You do a Taylor expansion of the expansion, and you write the expansion at the point where you are taking the wedge, plus the theta de lambda, but the theta de lambda is just given by the Rasch-Hadoop equation. Now you put all together, and let me put to zero for a moment expansion and shear, and from this and conservation of energy, you find the Einstein equation with a cosmological constant. You find the integrated form. You have to take away the integral, peel off basically this null vector. This generates the possibility to have something proportional to the metric, and then you find the Einstein equation. Now this is quite interesting. And then given that this is a generic pointer spacetime and you can do it in any point, this is the dynamical equation that you would expect generically. So this is quite interesting because it's just a thermodynamical reasoning that is leading you. And I want to stress also the entropy is entanglement entropy. A priori has nothing to do with gravity. No, it's just due to the fact that you have a quantum vacuum and some causal structure. Now, this would be interesting, but I would say this would not be enough for me to tell to start saying, there must be emergent gravity. There must be some atoms of space-time. There is structure in space-time. Because that, at the end of the day, I feel, but this is really a personal opinion, that is something that any theory of quantum gravity should recover. It's just the reasoning that if a theory of quantum gravity has a consistency check as horizon thermodynamics, so what I told you should work anyway. So it's interesting that it works, but it's very difficult to make out what it tells you. But there is more than that, because you see, I cheated. I put to zero the expansion and the shear. What that a priori cannot be taken to equal to zero, because at the point P, you are taking, remember that diagram was suppressing dimension. Point P, there is actually a two surface to which the null congruence is orthogonal. So now these two surfaces a priori can have non-zero expansion and shear. So it wasn't legally possible in the previous slide to put the expansion and shear here equal to zero. However, yes.
It also requires a killing vector.
Sorry?
It also requires a killing vector.
Yeah, yeah.
It must be intended to have a killing vector. This is specific.
It's a local, the killing vector that is associated basically to boost here. No? There is a boost invariance because you are local in Minkowski. So this local Rinder wedge admits a local killing vector.
But doesn't this killing vector have to exist in the whole path like
one? No. All I would say is just a pure local statement. You have to take basically enough, a sufficiently small portion of space-time around this point P where the space-time is flat. So it is a statement that depends on the local curvature. If the curvature is very high, you need to take a smaller. So this is a local Rinder wedge with a local killing vector, or a quasi-killing vector. So it's all a local statement. And in a certain sense, has to be taken appropriately under control in perturbation theory. I'm skipping some technical detail here for brevity. I wanted to tell you something here. You see, theta can still be put to zero because when I equate this and this, you immediately realize that here there is the expansion theta calculated in the point, which is not much, is zero order in lambda, which is the affine parameter along the Rindler horizon, and it's not matched by any quantity. Here, everything is order one in lambda, is of order lambda. So theta can be imposed to be zero by consistency of the Clausius equation. However, the shear cannot be imposed to be zero, and the shear not imposed to be zero is interesting because the only way you can make sense, if you take it into the equation at this point, you don't recover Einstein equation. So what you can try to say, you say, well, maybe I'm not working with a Clausius equation at equilibrium, but I'm doing near equilibrium thermodynamics now. So I introduce what is basically internal entropy term, or if you put it on the other side of the equation as a much dit term, and I call this extra term part, you see, when you do this near equilibrium thermodynamics, you identify a reversible part of your Clausius equation and an irreversible term. It's like I'm telling you, when I'm doing this, part of the heat I gave to the table is going in phonons. These are the part that was the flux in the stress energy tensor. But part of my heat goes in heating up the table. If you check with a thermometer, this table, if I start doing this, gets hotter. Right? Because not all is transforming mechanical energy. Now, this is why what is happening. I'm exciting internal degrees of freedom. There are no waves of the lattice of the table, phonons. These are really excitation of the atomic sites. So this term here would play the same role. It will be a reversible internal entropy production. So there is this flux of heat that goes through the horizon. Part of it goes in changing the horizon size. Part of it goes in this internal entropy production. Now, look at what, if you try to identify what is this term, this term is well known in GR, and it's the so-called Hartle-Hawking tidal heating. So what is telling you, and you know what is this Hartle-Hawking tidal heating, is when I take a black hole, I create a deformation on its horizon, I take away, I don't know, a satellite that I've used to create this deformation, the deformation of the horizon is relaxed by a flux of gravitational waves. The way to describe this dissipative process is through this Hartle-Hawking term. So you see what is happening. First of all, I couldn't have put the gravitational waves in the reversible part because gravitational waves do not admit a covariantly conserved stress energy tensor. So where the gravitational waves were? The gravitational waves are in the irreversible part of the transformation. So the gravitational waves are not the phonons. They are not on space-time in this picture. The gravitational waves are like heat fluxes in the table, if this table is space-time. So this is why we cannot localize them precisely, but they're damn well physical. I mean, I can heat up, I put the thermometer here, I do this many times, the thermometer will change at some point. So I find this, this is the point where I think that this approach of space-time thermodynamics is telling you that there is something funny going on, because if you can heat it, it has microstructure. So, one final comment, the ratio between this shear viscosity coefficient and the coefficient that you have introduced to cut off the entanglement entropy is exactly the so-called KSS bound, h bar over 4 pi. And in a different work with Christopher Ehling and Alfredo Kirko, we show that you can reproduce basically the viscosity, this coefficient, with a Kubo formula. With a calculation which is matching basically the calculation of entanglement entropy. So it looks like the quantum fields on a curved space-time are somehow inducing a geometrical quantity in a picture that may resemble in many ways induced gravity a la Sakharov. So, but I don't want to discuss this further. I just want to point out that, yes? I just wanted to say that for me, this was the point. It's just a starting point to try to convince you that there are some arguments for saying that there is microstructure in space-time in the sense of emergence.
But this is just my confusion. Is the claim that the Einstein equations are not exactly satisfied if you look too microscopically at the short time scale?
No, I wouldn't say that. You see, the problem, just in this approach, just in this approach, you can always pick up this two surface B at the bifurcation point to be shearless, without shear. It's an arbitrary choice. Yeah, in the first paper. Then in the second paper, I realized that this was not legal.
So is it legal?
This paper, look at this paper, and you will realize that in the first paper, he's doing exactly this. He said you can take it equal to zero. But then he realized that you don't have an argument, a strong argument, to take it equal to zero because the relaxation, I mean, there is a technical point that tells you that this is an unfair statement. And if you don't neglect it, you get something interesting because you get this Hartle-Hawking tidal heating term. If you don't put it in the irreversible part of the, if you put it in the reversible part, you separately solve the equation for the reversible part, and that gives you the Einstein equation. Right. The reversible part is Einstein equation, and the irreversible part is Hartle-Hawking tidal heating, which is related to gravitational waves. Okay.
Sorry, isn't there your subtlety that you don't tell me about the bulk viscosity?
Okay, the bulk viscosity, the bulk viscosity is zero. Here is zero because theta has to be zero by what I said before, it's not matched in GR.
If you
now take,
at the same thing, it's not legal. If you really look at that.
At this level of perturbation theory, if the next order would be non-zero, and is negative if you do Safla-Calada-Moore. But if you do gravity fluid duality, it's proved to be exactly zero, no?
Yeah, but it's very different from this.
And it's related. Actually, it's not so different as it might seem. It's related. But anyway, but if you do, for example, this gravity fluid duality or Rindler or Strominger, you get that the bulk viscosity is exactly zero. The problem is that the way it was done by the Moore, it was not. You see, you have to do it in the black hole is negative, but the black hole doesn't satisfy the hydrodynamic limit. The mean free path is not much smaller than the size of the black hole they coincide. So if you do it in Rindler or in a planar black hole like a black brain, then the bulk viscosity is exactly zero in this gravity fluid hydrodynamics. So, but can we postpone that?
Yeah, not for generic. I mean, this is the thing which is always put under the rug in this business. You know, and I think it is one of the central problems of this approach. You like to have all the viscous terms to be the right.
You can have. Okay, well, it's a bit.
The place where it's so properly, I think it's not in Schrödinger, it's in the free gravity of Minuala. Because there it's in India.
Yeah, but I
have. And there it's because it's timeline. It's not known.
We can discuss this later because yeah.
That's a big, you know. And you have to say that all the literature is just hiding this fact that, you know, if it was positive, then we could say we have a thermodynamic analysis. This negative terms of, if you have negative entropy production.
But if you do the, I don't understand your point, because if you do the hydrodynamic approach on Rindler, you don't get the bulk viscosity. You perturb basically the Rindler horizon. You look at the Rindler, at the horizon as a kind of, you have a basically an Navier-Stokes equation. The bulk viscosity is zero in that.
But you put theta equals zero. Yeah,
No, you don't put it. It comes zero. It's a constraint. Is in this work by Strominger, then there is this other work by Compere, Marical Taylor. I mean, there is a stream of this paper were basically in 2010, 2011.
No, where all the derivation from Jacobson, it's put by hand. I mean, it has to be said.
No, theta here is not put by hand because otherwise it's not consistent to the expansion. Here is order lambda, here is order zero lambda. Theta has to be zero, otherwise the Clausius relation doesn't hold. Okay. So anyway, this was more an argument to telling you that there were these terms that are strongly suggesting, you know, this microstructure. So, of course, if you want to do, if you then suppose this approach of imagined gravity, and undoubtedly there are many approaches that you can call emergent gravity. The point I want to make in this slide is simply that emergent gravity is not a theory. Is a scenario, call it a paradigm. It's something really that is now misused in many ways. A lot of people would tell you, I heard many people doing the SCFT, that they consider that in a form of emergent gravity rather than a duality. So I'm just a caveat that the word emergent gravity is not associated to a definitive approach, you know? It's just the idea that somehow you don't have to quantize the metric, or quantizing the metric is a bit like quantizing, or quantizing Einstein equation is a bit like quantizing hydrodynamics. You can speak of phonons, and that you can do very interesting things with phonons, even with gravitons. It's not that there are no gravitons, but somehow if you want to, at the end, the space-time emerge from fundamental objects which are not quanta of space-time per se. This is all I want to say. Yes?
Isn't it really just a verbal distinction? For example, if you take the most orthodox loop quantum gravity spin foam point of view, fundamental physics is quantum geometry, and classical geometry, classical space-time, classical gravity are all emergent. And then they may be emergent through exactly the same mechanism that you would study with the blah, blah, blah ideology of condensed matter underlying.
I think that in the loop quantum gravity, you should have, because if I talk with Carlo, Carlo, there was a meeting in which Abai was making your point, and Carlo was very much against it. So I never try, I don't want to enter in. I would agree with you, I would agree with you. It's perfectly possible that at the end, spin foam is the fundamental object. It's not, but then what you call space-time is an emergent concept in this sense, again.
Yeah.
There are point of view different in the community, all I can report. The people that say that loop quantum gravity is philosophically different because it's starting quantized geometry somehow.
But it doesn't matter where you start from. At some point, you have a hypothesis as to what underlies space time. What is the fundamental thing that underlies space time? And your job, where that hypothesis comes from, doesn't matter scientifically. Your job is to demonstrate the emergence of our world from that hypothesis.
You shouldn't convince me. I totally agree with you. Doing this emergent gravity is all very fancy at the moment, but I want to stress it's very hard. Let's face it, emergent gravity is a very hard job. First of all, you have a theorem, which is the so-called Weinberg-Witten theorem, which basically tells you that no spin two particle can be emergent if you have a Lorentz invariant, engage invariant currents, and conserve stress energy tensor. So, of course, if you have emergent symmetry of space-time, like Lorentz breaking, this is bypassed. So in a certain sense, the first easy workaround is to imagine that the space-time is really emergent, a little bit like this table. So the underlying physics has a typical scale, has a preferred frame, and this would be a workaround of the Weinberg-Witten theorem. Of course, you may want to go for the hard way, and I will give you a very good reason to go for the hard way, because violating Lorentz invariance is not an easy job, in the sense that violating is too easy. Keep it at bay and not having a violation hitting you even at low energy is another matter. So you would like maybe to have a scenario where you have emergence, but you don't have Lorentz violation. You have a theory that is at all scale Lorentz invariant. This is the hard route, and maybe it's the only route that will work in the end, I don't know. But let me just tell you a couple of things regarding this possibility. I don't know if you are familiar with the so-called Voronin-Yatovsky theorem. There is an axiomatic derivation of special relativity dating back from 1911, which is, I think, very interesting to know because it's basically assuming very few things about the fundamental structure of space-time and deriving Lorentz transformation just on the basis of that. So it's basically assuming that you have a relativity principle, that means a democracy of inertial frame. It's assuming homogeneity of space and time, and isotropy of space. And in furthermore, it's assuming precausality. It's telling you that if I have two events which are colocal, that means along the same word, the word line of the same observer, these two events have the same order in any system of reference. You cannot, by any transformation, invert the order of events. So in this sense, it's called precausality, right? Now, if you put this ingredient together, No, colocal events.
Right, but if the observer is very far away from the two colocal events, that observer also has to be...
Oh, yeah. It doesn't entail relative locality, if this is what you have in mind.
Yeah.
It's excluding. In fact, you have to relax something like this.
That's
okay.
Where
right. So, anyway, it's an interesting comment. We may expand on that later. If you take this... these ingredients together are allowing you to find the Lorentz transformation with an invariant speed, which only experiment will tell you a posteriori if it's the speed of light. Actually, it's worse than that. It depends on the physics of your rulers and clocks. If you're a bat and your physics is basically sonar physics, you will conclude that the invariant speed is the speed of sound. There is a very nice novel by Trautmann that was discussing about the bat discovering the Lorentz group with the speed of sound and then doing a travel agency. I don't know if you haven't seen it, it's a very nice one. They do a travel agency, then they go bankrupt because someone discovered that you can travel faster. Anyway, so if you want to do something new and you want to not break Lorentz invariance, can you break anything else? And the answer is that it's very, very difficult to break anything else. So, break precausality. So far, nobody dared to do it. Of course, Lee immediately. It was the first things that happened in mind to Lee. But normally people stay away from violating pre-causality, mainly because it's very difficult then to get same things out of the theory, but nobody has worked really hard on this problem. You can break the relativity principle, okay, then you get you have a preferred frame and you get local Lorentz invariance violation. People have tried to break isotropy, and the interesting thing is that if you break isotropy, basically boost in one direction and boost in another direction are not equivalent, what you get is that you get that the metric, you can get still a reduced symmetry group, relativity group, with an invariant line element, which is a Finsler geometry. This is quite interesting. An example of this is the so-called very special relativity proposed by Glashow, and later on Gibbons recognized that the invariant line element is a special Finsler geometry called Bogoslowski metric. You can break homogeneity, of course, but if you break homogeneity, that is very hard to do because you immediately realize that what you have to give up if you break homogeneity is the operative meaning, basically, of coordinates. Because breaking homogeneity in the sense that you start assuming that zooming in your space-time, this is not scaling invariant, you see something different, it means that if you take coordinates in flat space that normally have an operational meaning, I'm not talking about GR now, so difference of x or difference of t generally are the distance and duration. Now, if you give up homogeneity, you immediately realize that you lose the Euclidean structure, and this is at the base of this interpreted at this operative meaning of coordinate. This can be very interesting because if you give up this interpretive operative meaning of coordinate, it may be that you have to redo your physics on the whole space rather than you don't have anymore the standard link between coordinates and velocity, and hence momenta, that you have in standard physics. So it's a route that is not being very well explored, but it's still interesting.
Question regarding Finsler geometries. You mentioned this process matter system so that can model in some way, right? Emergence. So, you know, there are these process matter systems which people see, the Lorentz cone and stuff like that. Has anyone looked at the, obviously there you can break it up.
Yeah.
So has anyone ever looked at the Finsler geometry in that context as far as you know?
Me? but I haven't done any work on that. It's quite difficult to. Generally, these are systems where you have an Art Lorentz breaking, so somehow you have to cook up a system that doesn't have, or at least has an hidden Lorentz breaking in some way, and then you can try to see if there is a Lorentz geometry, a Finsler geometry. Anyway, there are generic treatments. And this is something I published with Matt Visser and Carlos Barceló, where we were doing basically a normal mode analysis, take a Lagrangian, do perturbation theory, and try to see how they perturb with a generic Lagrangian. Depending on the form of the Lagrangian, you may have that basically the propagation can be described with a single metric, multimetric, or in the worst case scenario, with a Finsler geometry. So this is, you can find it on the Living Review of Relativity that I published on analog gravity. So, coming back, still I want to just make a remark. It's not impossible to get exact Lorentz invariant from a discrete model. People have done it in causal sets, although maybe some people here will not completely agree on the success of this. I would say that it's really very interesting what they are doing, because at the end of the day, I wouldn't understand how they could get avoidance of Lorentz breaking in causal set theory. The crucial point is that they don't take a realization of a discrete realization of a space-time and then you just zoom out, you increase the numbers. You need to average over many realizations, and this averaging in general does not converge to the space-time you want to reproduce, but does have large fluctuation. This enforces you to basically introduce some non-locality in your theory to having this fluctuation to converge, to go to zero with large numbers of discrete sets of the causal set. And this is this row is basically one over this scale of non-locality to the fourth. And what you get, you see, is a modification, for example, for a scalar field of D'Alembertian, which has an infinite series of higher order D'Alembertian. This is what you would have guessed generically if you have to do something Lorentz invariant, power of the box, exponential of the box, with the difference that you have also this non-analytical term. So now, I don't want to make a very long story because it's not what I'm going to discuss today, but Non-locality seems to pop out also from some reasoning from loop quantum gravity, as well as it seems a very important ingredient if you want to have a consistent theory of relativity which incorporates some extra fundamental scale. And this is what is emerging in relative locality. These are probably all different forms of non-locality. One has to be careful with words. But still, I think that there may be behind this a kind of conjecture that discreteness plus local invariance, if you want to have both, then somehow you have to introduce non-locality at the end. So I just want to throw this. Maybe that this is the route that one has to follow. But let me go back on the easy route for the moment. So the easy route is Lorentz breaking. And the Lorentz breaking, I just wanted to list that if you do it in the matter sector, you better put it really, really very high, beyond the Planck scale, because we have a very good constraint now. If you do effective field theory, adding order by order Lorentz violation, with this sort of modified dispersion relation is what you get. And to make a long story short, we have plenty of constraint now, especially from high energy astrophysics, for this high energy UV violation of Lorentz invariant. And if not ruled out, it's severely constrained, okay? So you better have to protect your matter sector from Lorentz violation. What about gravity? In gravity, the things are a bit less clear. Observationally, gravity, we don't have that strong constraint. And people have proposed theories of gravity which incorporate Lorentz breaking. The easy way to do that is to add to the geometry. You have a metric, and you add an header field, basically a vector field, which with through some Lagrange multiplier you take to have a fixed norm equal minus one. Is basically purely time-like vector that is setting for you a preferred frame, okay? This is the so-called theory of Einstein-Eder. I think I'm a bit, we have a lot of interesting discussion, but now I'm short of time. But I just want to say that there are constraints, but that they haven't ruled out the theory at the moment. The theory is constrained, but not overly constrained. And this is a theory which is built. It's like an effective field theory for gravity, which is giving you second order field equation. Of course, you can think of a UV completion. And nowadays, most of the people look at the so-called Orava-Lipschitz gravity as a sort of UV completion, because this is a theory which has a second order Lagrangian plus fourth and sixth order term. These terms were added because by anisotropic scaling reasoning, they allow to argue for a power counting renormalizability of gravity. And this is what made initially the Orava gravity proposal so interesting. It was later on realized that this is a theory, with a preferred foliation. Basically, you have, if you like, your header field in this theory is hypersurface orthogonal, technically. It means that it can always be written as a gradient of a scala. So you have a preferred set of foliation, and you have really back to Newton, the standard box with your preferred time and this preferred foliation, which are surfaces of constant scalar. The scalar field is constant on the surface. The scalar field is called the Cronon for obvious reasons. Now, Einstein-Eder theory of gravity, if you force the Eder field to be hypersurface orthogonal, you basically go back to this L2. So in this sense, this Orava-Lipschitz can be considered UV completion. Now, how late is this now? So I want to just tell you that also in this case, you can do constraints. And I want to show you something we did recently. This M star, which is the scale of Lorentz breaking in Orava gravity, is already known that should be between a few millielectron volt from sublimeter test of gravity and 16 GeV. This is interesting. It cannot be at the Planck scale, the Lorentz breaking in Orava Lipschitz gravity. And it cannot be because you have the scalar field becomes strongly coupled, basically, at this energy. And in order to avoid the problem with the scalar field, you want that the L4 and L6 Lagrangian, the higher order correction, the UV completion, becomes important when the scalar field starts to misbehave, basically, said in few words. So what you want is that M star is at least of this order, if not smaller, so that you don't have to worry of this entering in the strong coupling regime, which would could spoil the power counting renormalizability. So this is the range in which it was initially forced to be M star. The point I want to make is that, however, if you have a violation in gravity, this cannot be confined to gravity because gravity coupled to all the matter. So generically, you would expect that also matter acquires Lorentz breaking. Now, let me do an assumption, which is more than an assumption because of something I will say before later, that also matter acquires a Lorentz breaking term at, at least of order p to the fourth. I'm not assuming that acquires terms in the sense of coefficient of p squared different than the speed of light, otherwise we would have seen it. So whatever is the way to make this theory variable, you better have to protect these terms. There is an idea about how to do this that I will cite briefly later. Just take for the moment the idea that if you modify gravity, the Lorentz breaking propagates in the matter sector. And now I want to say something about what can be the scale of Lorentz breaking in the matter sector associated to this propagation. What we have done is that we have taken the synchrotron spectrum of the Crab Nebula and we have reconstructed the synchrotron spectrum in this theory with that modified dispersion relation. And with current observation with the Crab Nebula, you can exclude at 95% confidence level that the scale of Lorentz breaking in the matter sector can be 10 to the 16 GeV. So it is for sure impossible that if there is a percolation of Lorentz violation from Rava gravity to matter, the scale of Lorentz violation is of the same order. It has, and it cannot be smaller than 10 to the 16 GeV like it should be this. So there is no window of opportunity. You must have a mechanism that not only protects the p square coefficient, but only protects the p4 coefficient in such a way that the Lorentz breaking happens at much higher energy than 10 to the 16 GeV. Okay.
So what's the argument of the synchrotron bound? I mean, they can't use anything, any other process to it.
The other process that were proposed before were constraining these things to be larger than 10 to the 11 GeV. While we are forcing it to be smaller than 10 to the 16. That implies that somehow you need a mechanism that protects not only the lowest order operator, the relevant operator in matter, but also the relevant operator, but also the irrelevant one, the dimension six operator. You see what I mean? Which is far less trivial, I mean. So this is important, is an example of the two major problems of doing Lorentz breaking theory. There are two major problems now on the carpet. One is the naturalness problem. The other one is the breakdown of black hole thermodynamics. What I mean by the naturalness problem is what I just told you. Once you have Lorentz invariance, it's difficult to confine it. You cannot just assume that Lorentz invariance is broken with dimension six operators or dimension eight operators, because when you have radiative correction, basically they will percolate to lower order operator. If they percolate to dimension four operator, that means the coefficient in front of p squared, the limit speed at low energy is different, you will have huge constraints you have to face. So this is the problem in effective field theory with Lorentz violation. And there are the main, at the time, basically three solutions that have been proposed. There are many of them, but I listen to this because I think these are the ones that are more exploited. One is that you have a custodial symmetry. For example, supersymmetry has been claimed as a way to protect the lower order operator, then it's broken, but then you get correction which are order of the supersymmetry scale divided by the Lorentz breaking scale to some power. If the supersymmetry scale is not too high, 3 years ago I was getting, if we will see the Lorentz symmetry at LAC, we would be okay. Now, let's say if the supersymmetry scale is not too high, then it would work because it shouldn't be higher, if I remember correctly, than with current constraint, than something around 10 TeV. Okay, so My statement is not rigorous because it depends a little bit on the models. Eh? It's a ballpark. You can improve a little bit on that. So the other one is a proposal by Maxim Pospelov and Shen, which is very much in line with what I just told you. If you have that the scale that only gravity is breaking Lorentz invariant and not matter at the three level, and the scale of violation in gravity is way lower than the Planck scale, then you may have a mechanism that protects matter for the simple reason that the coupling is G Newton. So if you do your homework and you look at the coefficient in front of the P square for matter, the low energy speed of light, it gets a contribution which is of the order substantially of the scale of Lorentz breaking in gravity divided by the Planck scale that is coming from G Newton to some power. So if this, if you are very hard in breaking Lorentz in gravity, you may have that you are as a counterpart protect the matter sector. But this is very expensive because you are basically paying off this with low energy, relatively low energy violation of Lorentz invariance in gravity. Finally, there is a recent proposal to have an improvement of the original work by Nielsen about a renormalization group with the local Lorentz invariance as an infrared fixed point, by having strong coupling at the Planck scale that would improve the renormalization group flow so that basically you are Lorentz invariant when you arrive at low energy really. So the other big problem is the second law of thermodynamics. This is when you talk about the second law violation, you always have to put this citation by Eddington. And the issue here is very simple. Imagine that I have now a case in which I have two matter fields that have different limit speeds. So dispersion relation is omega square equal c square p square, where c square is different for matter A and matter B. So this implies that the radius of the horizon for A and B are different. In particular, if B is CB, the limit speed for the B matter is larger than CA, then RB is less than RA, and TB, Hawking, is greater than TA because it goes basically like one over the radius, right? Now, if this is true, then you can build the two shell of B matter and A matter. And what it's doing is that you can take the shell so that the temperature of the Hawking radiation for the B matter is greater than the temperature of the shell of the B matter, which is greater than the temperature of the shell for the A matter and greater than the Hawking radiation for the A matter. So what is happening? It's happening that you can send the heat from here to here and from here to here again. And what is implying that you are exchanging heat from something cooler to something hotter. And you are violating the second law. So this is just an example. There are more examples of violation when you are in this setting. So what's going on? It looks like violation of Lorentz invariance breaks down horizon thermodynamics. But you see, I started saying that horizon thermodynamics and space-time thermodynamics was the motivation for emergent gravity. Then I say, well, emergent gravity, the easiest way is break Lorentz invariance. And then Lorentz invariance is destroying what I motivated my research. So this was definitely a bad score for Lorentz invariance. So what is the solution? Well, immediately people say, well, but what about the UV completion? Maybe that if we have a UV completion of the theory, this problem goes away. And this is what we are going to see in the last part of the talk. So the new hope came from the fact that people started studying black hole solution in Astenader of Orava gravity. Given that the black hole solution are considered low energy solution, basically, the black hole solution in Astenader and Orava gravity are the same. Spherically symmetric solutions, furthermore, are automatically hypersurface orthogonal. So the two theories given really share in this case, and for spherically symmetric black hole, the same solution. Now, what they realize is that inside a black hole in Orava gravity or Astenader gravity, there is a surface where a constant chronon, one of these constant chronon foliation, these are hypersurfaces of simultaneity. If you want to travel on one of these hypersurfaces, you have to move at infinite speed in chronon time. So even the fastest particle would lie on this surface and cannot go back from one surface. It has to move upward in chronon time. This is an absolute time, like Newton. Now, If one of these surfaces becomes compact, then you are done. Why? Because if the surface becomes compact due to gravity, even if you propagate at infinite speed, you have to go inward. So this is a trapping region. It's the boundary of a region from which not even infinitely fast moving signal can escape. And this is why it's called the universal horizon. So there is a notion of causally disconnected region, even in Lorentz breaking theories. Now, of course, in order to fill this universal horizon, you must have a dispersion relation of the sort I showed before, the one with the higher p to the 4, p to the 6, and so on. Now,
is this thing stable under perturbation?
Under spherical shear perturbation, it is stable, it has been shown. There seems to be, it's something I was going to say in the conclusion, there is an open issue about stability under unspherical shear perturbation. It's not clear. There is not a bulletproof demonstration both ways, and there is people working on this. Okay. Also, technically, this is a region where the header field, which you remember is always time-like everywhere, is orthogonal to the killing field, which inside the black hole is inside the killing horizon is space-like. The killing field, I mean, in a spherical symmetric static black hole, DDT, that means the one associated to staticity, stationarity. Okay? By the way, there is work done here by Ashfordi and Mann, which showed that you can get this universal horizon from a stellar collapse in Oravali ship's gravity. So one digression is that I was very puzzled when I see these real things for the first time, because I had in a paper by 2004, this is drawn by me by hand, while the other two people were drinking beer in a, okay, there's a, every time I see this, I get again this, I was phoning them and they were telling me that they were working and I could hear people drinking beer and they were in a restaurant. So anyway, this was basically a black hole diagram, Carter-Perros diagram, of an acoustic black hole that you do when you have an acoustic geometry, which is done with a flow that somewhere goes to minus infinity, the velocity goes to minus infinity. We call it the unphysical black hole, because basically you need to have an acoustic geometry where the velocity flow diverges at some point to simulate the singularity here. So I didn't see here any universal horizon, and I was bothered by this. Why I didn't have any universal horizon? I was, this could be a geometry in a Bose-Einstein condensate where you have the modified dispersion relation and so on. And now the realization is that if you try to do it in an acoustic geometry, the problem what it is, that the so-called header field, you can pull out an header field, but depends on the velocity of the flow, which is also in the metric. So the metric and the header field are not independent in acoustic geometries, or at least in the one you normally work with. And if you try to impose the condition for the universal horizon, that means that the killing vector becomes orthogonal to the header field, you get that it's never zero. And this is due to the fact that somehow you are working with a too simple system. But I'm convinced that if you can create an analog model where the metric is completely independent by the header field, the guy that modified the dispersion relation for quasi-particle, maybe you can have an analog model of this situation. Anyway, in this particular situation, you can just work out the algebra. You see what is the header field, and you see that it's never zero, so you cannot have this universal horizon. Well, this was just because for my sanity, because I was really annoyed that I hadn't seen any universal horizon having a more or less the same black hole. So once you have the universal horizon, people started thinking, okay, maybe I can try to find again a thermodynamics law in the universal horizon. And noticeably, there is a work by Mattingly and collaborators, so where they found out the first law for the universal horizon with quantity related to the co-universal horizon. And even more than that, they found out with a tunneling method calculation a la Parikh-Wilczek, they found out that if you look at with this method, that the probability of tunneling, it looks like there is a temperature, and this temperature is some weird function of the surface gravity you would calculate on the universal horizon. There is a caveat here that unfortunately I didn't have space to put, but I'm telling you. The caveat is that when you have a space-like surface, not a null killing horizon, well, you don't have a killing horizon, and this is not a killing horizon because the vector orthogonal to this horizon is the header, it's not the killing vector. The several definitions of surface gravity we are used to use do not coincide. And you have to be very careful which surface gravity you use. They use the definition of surface gravity, which is what normally, here it cannot be seen, is well, is what we call the generator, generally called the generator surface gravity, square root of nabla mu ki, nabla nu ki, where ki is the killing vector. So they, and this one, notice, was not appearing like kappa over 2 pi. It was in a weird combination, which wasn't kappa over 2 pi as usual. Anyway, this calculation seemed to hint that there is a temperature associated to this universal horizon. But of course, it's a calculation which doesn't tell you exactly what is happening, and is assuming that there is the Uru vacuum, that basically the, for the free-falling observer at horizon crossing, at universal horizon crossing, you see vacuum. The stress energy tensor is zero. Okay, so what we have done then is like, let's investigate a little bit better the structure of this space-time, and in particular, what do physical rays in this space-time? So this slide is just showing you for completeness, but you don't need to read anything. This is the metric that we are using. Remember, there isn't just the metric, there is also an header field. There are two solutions that are well known in this field. I'm just giving you the specific form of this function for this solution. And we have studied these two solutions. And what we have done, taken a given dispersion relation, modified dispersion relation at high energy, and we have basically identified the conserved quantity, because what is happening in this space-time, that now the matter moves under the influence of the metric, but it's not following the geodesics of the metric, because there is also the header, right? Now, given that there is also the header, what is happening is that the trajectory that the matter is following, point by point, would be a function of space, but also of the energy of this object, because at high frequency it would have a standard dispersion relation. At a low frequency it would have a standard dispersion relation. At high energy it would have a non-standard dispersion relation. So we identified a conserved quantity in this setting, which happens to be again the killing energy observed at infinity. And using this conserved quantity, we eliminated the momentum dependence from the trajectory so that we got in the end a trajectory which was just space-time dependent, so that can be plotted. Then you take basically Eddington Finkelstein coordinates. Unfortunately, here the projector is not showing. Here is there is the killing horizon, and here is the universal horizon. Here there is the central singularity. The same here, where you see KH is killing horizon, UH is universal horizon. These are just the two solutions I discussed before. Okay, so let's see what happens now that you are able to plot the rays, the physical rays, how they behave in this space-time. Take this solution. The rays, you see, the color here, it means the energy as well. So violet, as normally is more energetic than red, okay? So here is going from high energy to low energy. So here is look at the structure. You have that at the universal horizon, there is, unfortunately, I didn't have the picture with the, but here basically there is exactly the same peeling off, exponential peeling off structure that you normally see at killing horizon in standard black holes. And then you have that all the rays, you see, independently from the energy, they peel off at the universal horizon. And these outgoing rays, what they do? When they reach the killing horizon, depending on their energy, or they pass through, basically undisturbed, because they are very high energy, it's obvious why, you know? If you are a very high energy ray, you don't see the killing horizon, because for you, you are much faster than the speed of light, so. But if you have a low energy ray, what happens is that you linger close to the killing horizon for a while, and then you escape to infinity, okay? The situation in the other solution is identical. So what we have learned? We have learned, first of all, that the rays, the physical rays, are behaving in this space-time at the universal horizon they do what normal rays, relativistic rays, do at the killing horizon. And at the killing horizon, something weird goes on, because the low energy part of this ray seems to be reprocessed, somehow fill this killing horizon. Then we have calculated, basically, what we have done. We have calculated the surface gravity associated to the universal horizon, not now using some a priori formula taken by... We have adopted what is the so-called Peeling surface gravity, which is something you can, of course, define also for killing horizon very well. It is basically the surface gravity that enters in the exponential. When you have e to the minus ku and tells you the peels off, that is actually, even in non-static situation, if you check what is the surface gravity that enters in Hawking radiation, it's that one. It's not the inaffinity as defined very often in textbook. The inaffinity and the peeling surface gravity coincide in static situation. If you have a dynamical situation, like a slowly evaporating black hole, you better use the peeling off. This is something that you can find in a paper that we published with Matt Visser 3 years ago. Anyway, use this definition. We calculated in the two solutions the surface gravity. And then if you look at the temperature that Mattingly found with the Pyrick-Wilczek calculation, you get that that temperature is exactly kappa over 2 pi, our kappa over 2 pi. So it's exactly telling you that if you use the right definition of the surface gravity, you get the right answer, kappa over 2 pi for the temperature. What is happening here is obviously the other definition, the one that Mattingly was using, is a purely metric notion of surface gravity. So their answer was correct, but you shouldn't expect that it was linked to temperature in the usual way. Here, what you are really taking is the surface is the physical surface gravity which is felt by the ray, and it's determining their peeling off the universal horizon. And now it's standardly related to the temperature. The other point is that you may wonder if this is a covariant definition. You can rewrite this basically as the so-called kappa normal definition of the surface gravity in a covariant way. If you replace, basically, it's like the standard definition where you replace the redshift factor with u dot k, which is the natural generalization in this setting of the redshift. We are going toward the closing, and don't want to take you much more than that. So it looks like this universal horizon is really behaving like the killing horizon used to do. The peeling off, the exponential, the exact exponential peeling off is also suggesting that when you form a black hole, like in Ashbordi paper, by collapse, if you have any residual stress energy tensor, that will be exponentially dumped away at the universal horizon, where there is an exponential, exact exponential dumping off for any mode. This result at the end we find check that are independent on the dispersion relation. But then you may ask, well, but who is paying the bill? Where is the energy coming for creating particle by the universal horizon? Well, we don't know the definitive answer because we don't have any Benicio calculation of Hawking radiation. But all I can tell you is that if you take the energy as defined in the header frame, this energy changes sign across the universal horizon. So it looks like you may have a kind of ergo region from the respect of the header energy behind the universal horizon. And this may be the reason why you can create particles. This is much more, I mean, I don't want to say that, I don't want to say at the moment that I think that there is Hawking radiation from the universal horizon, because it's very difficult now to understand what is happening. I mean, of course.
You're talking about quantum or quantum? You're saying
quantum. All I'm saying is. Well, in standard Hawking radiation in a static black hole, how you can have particle creation? You need to have that, of course you have a quantum process that takes a virtual particle and you split them, but you have to throw the virtual particle with negative energy on the other side of the horizon to have the energy conserved, because there basically your energy becomes momentum, no? Or vice versa if you're doing the tunneling from inside. So in that sense, if you have a static black hole, someone has to pay the bill. If there is no time dependence, you need the ergo region. That is why I was arguing that you need somewhere a notion of ergo region to expect some Hawking radiation. Now, the problem is that this is far from clear. It's not enough to claim that there is Hawking radiation because there is this lingering. Have you seen all these modes are, most of these modes are sticking close to the Killing horizon for a long time. And we have tried to give a definition of how long they, do they stick close to the Killing horizon for a time sufficient to affect them? So we were saying, well, these modes have an intrinsic time, which is the inverse of their frequency close to the Killing horizon. And they define the lingering time, basically the difference between the kappa at the Killing horizon, defined as the surface gravity at the Killing horizon from the, with respect to the one that, with the modified dispersion relation, with respect to the one that I would define purely metrically. This is basically a notion of how long they stick close to the horizon, and I confront it with the intrinsic time of each mode. And what you get is that you see this ratio becomes very large for low energy modes. So in principle, what is happening is that you cannot neglect, they are living for their, from their point of view, they're living and they are affected by the Killing horizon very much if they are low omega. Omega is the Killing frequency at infinity modes. So you cannot expect that the temperature that you see at infinity is going to be just the temperature I show you, the one of the universal horizon. It's something more. And now, basically, some of our studies is going to try to compute what is the spectrum at infinity. My preliminary result seems to suggest that the spectrum at infinity is not going to be just a thermal bath at the universal horizon temperature. It's going to be something that depends both on kappa universal horizon, the surface gravity, both on the one of the Killing horizon. And it's unclear what is the role of the Killing horizon. It looks like it's a kind of a reprocessing surface that is affecting all the low energy modes. So I don't even know if it's going to be thermal at the end of the day. But you see, if it's going to be thermal at some temperature, then I think that all the problem with the generalized second law will disappear because you have a thermal object and this will be at the same universal temperature if this is the case, eh? For all the possible modes that are living on this space-time. So the UE completion would solve the generalized second law. This is the hope. So now in closing, so the conclusion, what it is, that the, well, here is basically recalling what I've said. So basically, we have argued that space-time can be an emergent concept. We have discussed that emergence is very difficult to deal with Lorentz invariance. If you want to deal with Lorentz invariance, it seems that if you want to preserve it, it seems you have to pay this with null locality, which will give another kind of phenomenology yet to be discovered, but somehow explored very fully. If you instead want to go for the Lorentz breaking way, you have these two major problems, naturalness, how you confine it to be at the Planck scale or at very high energy, and the generalized second law. Naturalness, I've shown you some of the proposal how to resolve it, and it seems that Orava gravity is also going in that direction, suggesting that the scale of Lorentz violation in gravity is smaller than the scale of Lorentz violation, whatever is the scale in matter, right? And I told you that you cannot have that, once you take into account radiative correction, there cannot be Lorentz violation only in gravity, right? It can, you can somehow protect matter, but you cannot completely avoid Lorentz violation. Finally, we have discussed the generalized second law, and I've told you that apparently that is a crisis for any Lorentz breaking theory. And the way that now is emerging is apparently that thermodynamic of horizon is resilient against Lorentz violation in a very surprising way, thanks to this presence of universal horizon. I think that you should not take the message that Lorentz breaking physics, hooray, we have done it and probably we're gonna make it work. I think it's very important, independently of how you think about it, first to test Lorentz breaking, because if you found most of your knowledge of nature on Lorentz invariance, you better test it, what happens when you break your fundamental laws. Secondly, because it's showing you something deep. If it's true that horizon thermodynamics survives Lorentz breaking, it means that at the root of the horizon thermodynamics, there is something much more fundamental. That somehow even this very fundamental symmetry is not crucial as it may seem at first sight, given that it's related directly to the light cone structure, right? So the lessons that to be learned here is what is really at the base of horizon thermodynamics. And I think that this, in this sense, the studies, that you like Lorentz Breccock or not, can help us understanding a bit better what is really crucial to get in order to get this thermodynamical behavior in gravity. Thank you.
What happens if you redo Jacobson Lorentz Breccock? What equation do you get?
Very good question. No question, because the okay, I tell you the story now and what is the hope. The story now is that Ted tried to do it, and what happened is that the header field becomes singular at the bifurcation surface. And that implies that substantially you cannot carry on his construction, at least in the standard way, in a theory like Eisenheder. We don't know. Recently, there is some work by Parentani, which is, let me add another point. Another thing I didn't say, but is very interesting to know, is that apparently Uru radiation, differently from Hawking radiation, is not robust against the Lorentz breaking. And you may understand why. Because for those of you that saw my talk yesterday, I said that Hawking radiation, the way you see that is robust against Lorentz breaking is that you may have a situation where the surface gravity, the scale of Lorentz violation, is very much separated by from the Lorentz breaking scale. If this separation is basically what helps you surviving in Lorentz breaking scenario. In the case of Uru, what is the scale that should protect you against Lorentz violation? You can always reparametrize the proper time and get rid of the acceleration. In the Rindler wedge, the temperature is 1 over 2 pi. There isn't a preferred acceleration, right? So you don't have a scale helping you surviving. Okay, this is the picture. And so you see that TED construction is in crisis from step one. However, there is recent work by Parentani that is hinting that in Lorentz breaking scenario, if you look at the geometry close to a large black hole, normally what you see, imagine you have a large virtual black hole and you go very close to this, you are a static observer very close to a very large black hole. You see basically planar horizon and your line element becomes basically Rindler. Now, the argument by Parentani is that in a realistic scenario of this black hole, if you do the same, you get something like the sitter. Because there is the expansion of the header field that may be non-null and provide you with a constant, basically, a scale. If that is true, it may be that this is the route to go, but nobody has done it so far completely. So there is a possibility, but it's not yet explored.
So what's the meaning of the decision horizon? Or is there
a horizon? No, there is an horizon. There is in the horizon, in the sense I told you, at low frequency.
It's a Rindler, right?
Yeah, now basically you can have scenario where the header field has a non-zero expansion, right? So if you have a non-zero expansion, you have a characteristic scale now given by the header field, not by the metric. And that characteristic scale can be used to achieve the separation of scale and make everything robust. So this is all I'm saying. I didn't look this in detail. By that, the causal structure, then this is still a black hole in this Orava theory, so all that I said is valid. Yes?
So in these Einstein ether models, which give universal horizons, do they take into account the vacuum polarization of the renormalized stress energy?
Okay, this is a very, very interesting question, which I didn't have time to expand. Okay, first of all, the question doesn't require an answer that has to do with Einstein Eder a priori. In a Lorentz breaking theory, there is a very a subtlety which is complicating furthermore the picture. Normally, if I take a star, a dilute star, and I start with Minkowski vacuum, and I let it collapse, and I form an horizon, you don't damn well that the final state has to be Uru. That means the state which is vacuum for the free-falling observer of the horizon and the temp mal on Sky Plus. It's a matter of regularity, and the fact that there is, basically, if the state is Adamar, remain Adamar, that you can renormalize the stress energy tensor at horizon crossing. If you are exactly in free falling, basically zero. If you're not exactly in free falling, there is a little residual that is exponentially killed by the exponential peel off I discussed before, and then you get basically Uru. Now, in Lorentz breaking scenario, it has not been proved, but it seems that it's possible. It's one of the other things that people is looking at. That the Lorentz breaking provides for you a UV regulator. So there is another state that in principle could be regular on a black hole space time in Lorentz breaking scenario, which is Boulware. Bulwer normally has a UV divergence at the horizon. There is a well-known calculation by Philip Candelas, I think 1976, something late 70s, I can't remember. But in this calculation, it was showing that there is a divergence due to vacuum polarization like 1 minus 1 over r to the square root. It's like there is a nice paper by Shama, Candelas, and Deutsch that are showing you that if you cut off this divergent term, it's like you have a minus a thermal spectrum close to the killing horizon that is counterbalancing the thermal spectrum that you would like to see at infinity. But this is divergent. Eh?
In Bulwer.
But it's divergent. If you have an horizon, that would be divergent. But if you have a modified dispersion relation, in principle, you can have a regular state. So if this conjecture is true, and it's something people is looking at, then you have a problem. When you have a star that collapses and forms a black hole, which is the vacuum chosen by the history of the star? If you have a universal horizon, this may be different, because a universal horizon, again, has now the properties of the killing horizon, and I would conjecture that naturally you will have an Urru state set at the killing at the universal horizon. So these are, again, conjectures that we are exploring. Again, it looks like without universal horizon, black holes do not work in Lorentz breaking theories of gravity. If universal horizon finally will be doomed because they're unstable, I would say that this is basically the final blow for any theory of gravity with Lorentz violation. I don't know if my colleague would agree, but this, my personal opinion would be to move to somewhere else.
Can you say something more about the entropy associated with this universal horizon?
Nothing very intelligent, I'm afraid, because all that people has done, this was done in the paper by Mattingly, is once you know the temperature, you can go back to the first law and derive what is supposed to be the entropy. And that the entropy is proportional to the area of the universal horizon.
Well, do you have a first law for the universal horizon?
Yeah, you have a first law. I said that before. Yeah, you have it was shown by Mattingly, Batrachaya, Berlund in a paper in 2012, but they found the first law. And there is I would say a more rigorous proof by Arif Mohd, which is a postdoc in our group, which is finding this the first law. And then from there, you can derive that at least the entropy of the universal horizon from a thermodynamical point of view should be proportional to the area of the universal horizon. But if you were asking me if there is a derivation of this entropy, I don't know, an entanglement or something like that, I don't know.
That's part of the question, what's your formula? Is your formula for the entropy the same or not? I can't see it.
Well, there is this symbol. This is a constant. Is a constant of the theory. Is a combination of parameters. I don't know if I have it in this slide or another slide. It's the same constant entering here. This is again a constant related to the Lorentz breaking term. So imagine it's a constant times the area divided by twice the entropy. What plays the role of the Newton constant in the original Lagrangian, which is related to the Newton constant by some constant, anyway. So it's basically area over the Newton constant times some constant, some combination of constant which are fixed by this C13 will have some value in your solution.
So in terms of the effective Newton constant, it's not the same formula as we're used to, is that right?
A over 4. Can't remember if that was the point is that I don't remember on the top of my mind the relation between this G and G Newton. No, I don't know the answer to this question. We can look, but on the top of my mind, I don't know if it's A over 4. Still, you see, in a certain sense, I don't know how much is. Also, this one wasn't kappa over 2 pi, no? And then when we calculated the right peeling, it became kappa over 2 pi. My impression is that probably you have to massage this one. I would be surprised
if it's. The usual argument, right, which is hand waving, you combine these two, the 4 pi and 2, which of course is 2 pi and 4, combined to 8 pi g Newton, which is what you need, Einstein's equations. The S is giving you r mu, the other thing is giving you t mu.
Right.
And so here, as I can
but
see,
you see that
8 pi, CAA is going to cancel. The only thing you get
Yeah, that is related to G Newton. Let me see if I have the formula for G Newton in the. No, you see, because this one is a different constant, but it's related to G Newton with a kind of simple, there is a proportionality factor. But I can't remember it. Now we can easily check it if you like later. It's in the paper by Mattingly. I think that at the end, things should turn out to be as usual.
The other thing, of course, is the entanglement entropy that you referred to. So if your microscopic model is some ultimately discrete matter, condensed matter kind of thing, then there will be a cutoff associated with that scale, and that should set this amount of entanglement entropy.
Oh, yes, but when you have modified dispersion relation, you don't need the cutoff. It's automatically cutoff. Is the cutoff is the law? There is this paper by Parentani and Jacobson.
You still have high frequency modes. The question is whether they contribute to the entanglement or not.
No, they don't, because they don't see the horizon. But the universal horizon, they would. No, you're right. I was thinking about the Killing horizon. You're correct. Then you have to put, as usual, your cutoff by n.
So there's a question why that would be related to the gravitational constant. Or is there any reason, can one see in any way that would be related to the gravitational constant?
You should try to do the standard argument that they normalize the gravitational constant in this action, you know. The standard argument of why it is related in standard entanglement entropy. This is what you're saying. Nobody has checked that, but I would say that this is what exactly you should try to check. Nobody has done, but you know, at this level, we still are trying to understand if there is okay radiation. Then, I agree with you. You should check if basically this renormalizes the Newton constant the way it normally happens with entanglement entropy.
Discussion on the questions of the second.